Welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dial, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. Here we go. Let's get into what I'm getting on. But before we do, I have a question. A question for you, the questioning medicine listening audience. Do I continue with this coronavirus, this COVID-19 continuous update as fast as I can possibly pump them out? Or should I try to go back to the old questioning medicine, the questioning medicine of old, where I just talk about other papers that are in the news? You see, some of you may or may not be COVIDed out. Don't want to hear anything more about COVID. It's too much. It's COVID all the time, everywhere you look. Unfortunately for me, that's basically all that's being published right now in most of the journals. Yes, there are definitely other journals and there are some normal publications coming out, but for the most part, if you look at the major journals, New England Journal of Medicine, JAMA, Annals, BMJ, they're all posting anything they can get their hands on about coronavirus. And as you have seen from this podcast, some of those articles are not so good, or maybe have something to be desired in the end when you really dig into them. So if you say, listen, Andrew, I like COVID, but maybe you could just sprinkle in some other factors or other articles in there or other discussions, then cool, I'll do it. And if you say, no, give me more of the COVID, baby. Give me Corona until I got no more limes and I got no more salt. Give me all the Corona you can throw at me, then I'm cool with that. Let me know. Andrew Belt, B-U-E-L-T at gmail.com. And with that, I must say, the last podcast, Wichita, Kansas, I see you out there. I don't know how many people are in Wichita, Kansas, but there were a lot of you that downloaded that podcast, and I appreciate your support. So with that, without further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Question Medicine 2020. Andrew Belt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's kick this thing off. There has been a lot of talk in recent days and weeks about the number of tests that are out there that we can test patients with. Of course, PCR is the best test. It's the most sensitive test. All you need is one RNA strand in there to be able to pull it out, and then boom, you got yourself the results that you're looking for. But there's also been talk about this antibody test. Let's get an antibody test. An antibody test would be wonderful, except for an antibody test doesn't necessarily tell you if you have active disease. It doesn't tell you the question that most patients are looking for. The patients are coming to you saying, I'm feeling sick right now. Am I feeling sick because I have coronavirus? And an antibody test won't show up until the antibodies are developed, which means you're likely not going to see the antibodies during the acute initial, within the first few days of the symptoms or reaction. You have to wait a while. So the antibody test is essentially worthless unless you're going to be testing individuals for the antibody test to see if they could be what I like to call vampire killers, meaning you have high antibodies, high antibody titers. You can go into this COVID room and you don't have to worry about getting COVID-19 because you've already been exposed. You already have the antibodies. Your body is going to fight this, except for just because you had coronavirus doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to develop the antibodies for it. And that is no better shown than in this paper from preprint titled Neutralizing Antibody Responses to SARS-CoV-2 in a COVID-19 Recovered Patient Cohort and Their Implications. What did this study show, you ask? Well, they took 175 Chinese patients who tested positive, PCR positive for COVID-19, and tested their antibodies. Now, we know PCR positive patients, all 175, should ideally develop antibodies. We know that they had the disease. Now, all these patients had relatively mild symptoms, according to the paper. However, the median length of stay in the hospital was 16 days. So I'm not sure exactly what practice they're performing over there in China, but if you have a patient in the hospital for 16 days, that's not necessarily a mild case of coronavirus. Now, of these patients, 6% of the patients had undetectable antibody titers, both at time of discharge and 2 weeks after discharge. So these people didn't develop antibodies, which could be some of the case reports or some of the news reports that we're hearing about these reinfections. Well, maybe they're reinfections, or maybe the body just never developed antibodies to begin with. And so now it's just the same infection that hopefully this time the body actually develops antibodies for. In the end, I'm not exactly sure what to do with this article other than to be aware that just because you're PCR positive on something does not mean that your body develops the antibodies for it, which can only make me wonder about some of our other tests, such as HPV. Maybe you test positive for HPV, but your body isn't developing antibodies for it because its baseline underground normal immune response is actually fighting the virus, which means that you don't then develop a full-blown immune response. Your T cells and cytokines are able to fight off the virus to help you fight away the infection. You don't develop antibodies because the antibodies aren't really needed. I'm not sure really what to make of this other than just pure epidemiological data that helps us assess maybe these quote-unquote reinfections that we read about in the news aren't actually reinfections. Yes, they are infections, but they're just repeat infections with the same virus. It's interesting, it's fascinating, and it's something that we should look further into in the future in other aspects of medicine. Now, one of the big parts of the COVID-19 research, one of the big hot topic debates is, what's the underlying risk of coronavirus? Meaning, what's the individual that I pass at Walmart or wherever I do my shopping that looks well, but is actually 48 hours away from having the sore throat and fevers? What's the individual that says, no, I feel great, but then develops COVID-19 3 days later? What is that baseline risk? Because if we knew the baseline risk, it would help us assess if one in two individuals is asymptomatic spreaders. Well, that's really scary. But if only 1% of the baseline people are asymptomatic spreaders, well, that's maybe not as scary. Who knows what the real number is, but in this paper in the New England Journal of Medicine titled Universal Screening for SARS-CoV-2 in Women Admitted for Delivery, in this paper in New York City, OBGYN physicians started screening every woman that came in for delivery for COVID-19. And they found that in this hotbed, New York City, those women that came in had a 15% positive rate for COVID-19. Those are scary numbers, not only for the physician, but also for the nurses and all healthcare providers that go in that room, as well as for the mother getting ready to deliver her child and hearing the news for the first time. By the way, you have COVID-19. And I say for the first time because in this study, 13% of the individuals had no symptoms. They had zero symptoms. They felt fine. They were ready to come in and deliver their child. They were happy that they had no symptoms because in this current pandemic, they had reached the end goal of getting to deliver their child without catching the coronavirus. And then, surprise, surprise, they actually did develop the coronavirus. Now, you might be saying, Andrew, that's interesting. 15% in New York, that's scary, but New York is a hotbed. New York has more cases of coronavirus than maybe any other place in the world. But what about other places? Other places that is not a hotbed? Well, also in the New England Journal of Medicine, there was a paper titled Spread of SARS-CoV-2 in Icelandic Population. And in this study that was obviously done in Iceland, they took 13,000 participants and they did something really cool. They took about 10,000 individuals that were high-risk individuals, those individuals in which your pretest probability was super high. And they said, these individuals are symptomatic. They've had recent travel exposure to high-risk countries, or they had contact with infected other individuals. Those are high-risk people. I think we would all agree those individuals, if we test them, they should test positive more likely or more often than just your random pull-you-from-the-street individuals. And they did. About 13% of the time, these individuals tested positive for the coronavirus. Now, they took another 3,000 individuals, and they just randomly sampled them, pulled them off the street, and said, let's test you. And of those, it was about 0.7%. Not 7%, 0.7% of the individuals they pulled off the street that felt well, looked well, had no problems, no complaints, tested positive for COVID-19. The question, the debate, the issue, the thing I have about this paper is if your institution or your location or your patient population is testing positive about 0.8% of the time, well, then either A, you're testing everyone, which I'm not really sure we have evidence that this is of any benefit whatsoever. And plus, the tests are still in shortage at this time, so we shouldn't just be shotgunning approaching this test to everyone. So you're testing too many people with low pretest probability. Or, as I mentioned in previous podcasts, you're getting a bad swab. You're getting a bad sample, and you need further education with your nurses, whoever's doing the swab, to do the swab appropriately. Of the high-risk population, the 13% of the individuals that did test positive for COVID-19, almost 50% of those individuals had a fever. This is key. This is far and away the biggest symptom that was reported among these individuals. Fever, 50%. It's a coin flip, but it's better than anything else that we have. And if you took all symptoms combined, cough, fatigue, fever, any symptom that you can imagine associated with COVID-19, then the individuals that tested positive, well, 93% of those that were in the high-risk category had COVID symptoms, which is great, but it's not something we can absolutely 100% hang our hat on, because 30% of the participants who tested negative in this random population screening also reported these symptoms. It's wonderful, but it's not everything. You got to take it all in picture, all together. What is the full history of the patient sitting in front of you? And yes, as you got older, you were more likely to test positive for the coronavirus. In fact, those in the random population screening group, none of the children under age 10, almost 900 kids under the age of 10, tested positive. You would think just by statistical error alone, if you test almost 900 children randomly under the age of 10, one of them would have the coronavirus. But nope, no, they did not. Is it because kids don't get the virus? Well, no, that's silly. Of course the kids do. But I suspect, and in my own observation, that kids are already somewhat socially isolated as is. I mean, look at a 10-year-old. They may not even be allowed to leave the square block of their own neighborhood. So maybe it's not that kids don't get the virus, but rather these kids are just not exposed nearly as much as adults are. Even when I go to the store and I see a kid with a parent shopping, the parent will touch almost everything that goes into the shopping cart. While the kid may touch a few items here and there and throw it into the shopping cart, the parent touches everything. The exposure is just so much less with children, which is maybe the answer to why children are not getting this virus nearly as often or nearly as much as adults. I think the quick take home from this article is that you should have a high index of suspicion when you're testing your patients. And if your only positive results or the results that are testing positive out of your patients is less than 1%, then you're doing no better than just random sampling off the street. Also, if they have a fever, 50% of the time, that was the key symptom, fever, 50% of the time in those individuals that were high risk with high pretest probability, that is something you can hang your hat on. And if they come in with a fever or they report a fever, put a mask on them, put gloves on them. You put a mask and gloves on you. Maybe don't even have them come in, just have them self-quarantine and have them know that you probably got the virus. And that's probably what's going on. And if the test is negative, do you really need the test results, if you have a high index of suspicion already? I would say probably not. And speaking of masks, in my last episode, or one of my last episodes here, I have talked about masks. Now I feel like, listen, they're probably the best thing we got right now. Why do I say that? Because it dampens the spread of the virus particles. Sure, that means you have to wear the mask appropriately. It has to be around your mouth. It has to be not touched every single time that it starts to fall. It has to fit properly. Because let's be honest, if there are virus particles on the outside of the mask, and then you're constantly rubbing the mask and rubbing your face, and then you're touching everything else or touching, you're just spreading the virus already. But hopefully you're spreading it to yourself. Hopefully the virus is on the outside of the mask, which is your virus that you already have, and you're preventing the spread to other people, which is the key factor in wearing masks is this prevention of spread to other people, not the catching it of yourself. Now, there was another article in the New England Journal of Medicine, and I swear I have nothing to do with the New England Journal of Medicine. It's just they've published a lot of really good and really bad stuff on the coronavirus here recently. And this article on masks was titled "Visualizing Speech-Generated Oral Fluid Droplets with Laser Light Scattering, April 15th, 2020. Here's what we know. Speaking, just general speaking like I'm doing right now, generates oral fluid droplets. In fact, some studies have shown that the number of droplets produced just by speaking is similar to the number produced by coughing. Ugh, that is gross. But in this study, they used an iPhone 11 camera. What great technology that we're at these days. They had an individual in a dark room with a green laser light, and he would say, "Stay healthy, stay healthy." And as you can tell, if you want to say it right now in your car, "stay healthy" has a lot of spitting syllables or slowables that come out with it. And with the laser light, you could see the spit or droplet particles coming out. And then when they put on this so-called mask, there was no droplet particles coming out. The video is super impressive. And I must admit, I watched the video before I read the article, and I said to myself, this is phenomenal. This is exactly what we all wanted to see. Was, look at this. You put a mask on someone, and all of a sudden, they're not creating droplets into the air. They're not spreading the virus to other individuals. This is phenomenal. And then I read the paper. And as with most New England Journal of Medicine papers, I was quite disappointed because this was the paper we all wanted. This was the paper that would easily, you could easily show, look, here's when droplets go out, here's when they don't go out. All you gotta do is put a mask on them. Except they didn't use a mask in this study. Instead, and I quote, "a damp washcloth over the speaker's mouth, the flash count remained close to the background level," end quote. What they're saying there is, we put a washcloth over the speaker's mouth and we couldn't see any droplet particles coming out other than what was just already ambiently sitting in the air at baseline. Even when he was saying stay healthy, there were no new droplets, no new particles flying into the air. This would have been awesome, except for they didn't do the thing that we all wanted them to do, which was actually use a mask. They used a damp washcloth. That what am I supposed to do? Carry a damp washcloth around with me and wear that over my face? Another trial that had a perfect idea gone completely wrong based on wanting to have a good headline, based on maybe they tried it with a mask, a surgical mask, and they didn't like the results. I don't know what the true result here is. I just know the way that they ran the study is not the way that they actually should have ran the study. So I'm frustrated, I'm upset, and I wish that academic medicine was just a little better. If they did run the study with surgical masks and it didn't show any difference, go ahead and tell us. I can handle it. I'm a big boy, but you didn't run the study like that, and it's so frustrating. Now, I am about to wrap this thing up, but let's not forget the horn. The horn being that this ship is getting ready to sail. This ship is getting ready to ride off into the sunset. And so the last article, here we go. Oh, there it is, there it is, there it is. Here we go. Okay, the last article is "Timing of Viral Shedding and Transmissibility in Nature Medicine." Now, this is for all my primary care physicians out there, all my staff members who are working on the front line in a clinic office or urgent care and actually seeing patients in these offices in which the patient says, "Nah, it's okay, I'm feeling just fine. Don't worry about me." Because as I've mentioned during this episode multiple times, the problem is not the individual that says, "I'm sick." We know that they're sick. We're taking caution. The problem is the individual says, "I'm not sick. I feel fine. Don't worry about me." Because those are the individuals that are likely the asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic spreaders. They're going to have symptoms in 24, 48, 72 more hours. They just don't know it yet. And during this time frame, they're spreading it to everyone. In this paper, researchers in China examined the viral load data on 90 COVID-19 patients, as well as the data on the timing of transmission to about 90 transmission pairs. Transmission pairs is the person that likely got infected by the person that was initially infected. So if I got the coronavirus, you would look at me, and then if I gave it to the better brain, which likely I'm going to because we live in such close quarters and we share droplets all the time, you would look at, okay, his symptoms started on day X. When does she develop similar or exact symptoms, or what's the correlation here on hours and time frame on when she got it compared to when he started having symptoms? So when they combine this data together, and assuming the incubation period of 5.2 days, the researchers found that the infectiousness began approximately 2 days before symptom onset and peaked at about 14 hours before symptom onset. And the really scary part is that they estimated that pre-symptomatic transmission accounted for 44% of the secondary cases. Meaning, I gave it to the better brain 44% of the time, or roughly half the time I gave it to the better brain, and I had no idea I was already giving it to her. I gave it to my work colleagues, and I had no idea I was already giving it to them. Because I said, no, don't worry about me. I'm feeling good. I'm feeling healthy. I'm feeling fine. I think that's why mask, social distancing, or rather physical distancing, be social all you want, but keep your distance, is really important, because it's these pre-symptomatic spreaders. It's the pre-symptomatic transmission that is really spreading this virus. And with that, I will wrap this thing up, and I will ask you, email me, AndrewBuelt, B-U-E-L-T, at gmail.com, and let me know, do you want more of the coronavirus, or do you want to go back to the old ways, or maybe you want a little bit of both? Can't have it all, can't have everything, so pick one, stick to one side of the fence. And before we close, let's quickly go over some of the articles that we talked about today. The antibody test is great, except for about 6-7% of individuals who are PCR positive will not develop or have antibodies when tested. So we can't hang our hat on the fact that they were PCR positive to really count for that they're going to have any antibodies for it. 1 in 10, or I guess 1 in 17, is not a great number. Asymptomatic spreaders are a big deal. And in New York, apparently about 13 to 14% of women that came in for delivery found out at time of delivery, guess what? It's a boy. And oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, you have COVID-19 and you didn't even know it. But that's a hotbed, and when you look at Icelandic information, it looks like the high-risk individuals, the people that have had recent exposure or high-risk travel, those individuals are testing positive at a rate of about 13%, while just a random sample from the population is testing positive at about 0.8%. So if your institution is testing positive at 0.8%, then you're not using a very good pre-test probability to test these individuals. You're no better than just a random sample population. Ugh, you got to do better than that. You got to have a higher pre-test probability. And speaking of pre-test probability, fever. 50% of those individuals in the high-risk group tested positive with fever. That is a big deal. That's probably the best thing that we can hang our hat on right now. The rest of the symptoms, sure, 20% of the time, 25% of the time, but almost 50% of the time fever, that is a big deal. And if you're going to run a paper and you want to get it published in the New England Journal of Medicine, well then go ahead and do a paper or a study that no one cares about, such as using wet washcloths over a patient's mouth or a person's mouth to test spit droplets, because we all know that no one these days is carrying a wet washcloth. So why you would test it, I have absolutely zero idea. And last but not least, all of you individuals on the front line seeing patients in the clinic who said, no, don't worry, I am A-okay. The beginning spread, the beginning of pre-symptomatic transmission starts at about 2.3 days, and the peak of the transmission occurs before symptoms at about 14 to 15 hours. 14 to 15 hours before they feel anything, they are likely the highest load of viral shedding, and they're probably in your office. Take care. Be safe. And if you learned anything during this podcast, if you learned anything at all, I encourage you to please pass it on to one individual on the front lines, because we're all the same right now. We're all scared. We all want answers, and we all want to do what's best for the patient. And so until next time, I will end this podcast as I've ended every one before it. Wait for the music. Oh, there it is. Here we go. Until next time, keep the quest in questioning.